From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on election night, primary night, June 22nd, last month. In Rochester, activists celebrated some dramatic victories. They had carried the motto, from the streets to the seats, and they supported candidates who had promised to dramatically reform and reduce policing, among other changes. Stanley Martin and Kim Smith won nominations for city council. They are poised to join council in 2022. But in New York City, Democrats chose a mayoral candidate there who is himself a former police officer and is unabashedly opposed to the most significant reforms. Eric Adams carried the slogan, "The prerequisite for prosperity is public safety." He said it would be a terrible idea to defund police, eliminate police, even dramatically reduce the number of police. In the New York Times, David Lanehart writes, quote, "In recent years, working class voters across races have grown uncomfortable with some of the progressivism of the Democratic Party. The white working class's move away from the party is a familiar story by now, and it's one that certainly involves racism, as Donald Trump's appeals to white identity made obvious. Yet the shift is not only about racism. If there were any doubt about that, the 2020 election, when voters of color shifted right, should have cleared it up. And last week's New York mayoral election has become the latest piece of evidence. Eric Adams ran a campaign with decidedly conservative themes. He ran as both a black man who had endured racism and a former police officer who would protect the city. How dare those with their philosophical and intellectual theorizing and their classroom mindset talking about the theory of policing," he said in his election night speech. You don't know what this is. I know this. I'm going to keep my city safe," end quote. And Lanehart concludes that the question now is whether Democrats are willing to listen. But those who seek change argue that week by week, month by month, the country is moving in their direction, and they shouldn't have to water down their goals. So let's talk about this. Our guests this hour include the winner of the recent Democratic primary for Rochester City Council. Kim Smith is on the phone with us. Kim, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me, Evan. Nice to be here.
With us in studio is a winner of the Democratic primary for Rochester City School Board and a former law enforcement officer. James Patterson is with us. Thank you for being with us in studio here.
Thanks for having me.
Former Mayor Bill Johnson, former mayor of the city of Rochester, is with us. Hello, Bill. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Rachel Barnhart is a Monroe County legislator. Rachel, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you, Evan.
So let me start with Kim. What's the lesson from June 22nd? Is it distillable into one sort of lesson? I know the media sort of tries to do that a little bit, maybe too often, but I'm curious to know if you think that there was a story or a lesson, especially for Democrats, that you can take forward.
I think the results of this election and the reason for the shift, I think it was both intentional and intuitive. I think it was intentional with the grassroots organizers who are on the ground, educating people on the issues of today, engaging them in politics, and then mobilizing voters to the polls. And I think it was intuitive on the part of the voter from paying attention to what they need and the needs of the community, relaying those needs to policy and political platforms, and then paying attention to the candidates and what they stand for and determining who is more aligned with their needs and values.
I'm curious to know, Kim, if you share, you know, sort of Pew Research has this construction. They don't just look at it conservative, liberal. They cut it up into nine categories, nine different categories on how Americans might be divided as an electorate from left to right on the spectrum. And in the New York Times, they take a look at this and they write, quote, "Among Pew's nine groups, the group that's furthest to the left, solid liberals, make up 19% of registered voters when Pew last did a full update of its categories. These voters have the views you would expect, strongly in favor of abortion access, affirmative action, immigration, business regulation, a generous social safety net, higher taxes on the rich, presumably police reform as well. And who are these solid liberals? They are disproportionately college graduates with above average incomes. They are also heavily white. Black, Hispanic, and Asian American voters are to the right of white Democrats now on many issues. Many voters of color are skeptical of immigration and free trade. They favor border security as well as some abortion restrictions. They are worried about crime, and they oppose cuts to police funding, and they are religious," end quote. That's from the New York Times. What do you think, Kim?
What do I think in reference to what, the mayoral election or what?
Well, I mean, I guess, is that how you see the electorate? I mean, do you think the farthest to the left tend to be white, college educated. Is that fair? Are we sort of overinflating certain voices, et cetera?
I think we are. I think when we look at who is showing up at the polls to vote, certainly that is the demographic, the solid liberals that he mentioned. But in terms of overall community perspective and the thinking of the leftist groups, I think it goes, I think it's a far reaching than what he describes.
Let me ask our guests in the studio for what they think here. And James Patterson is also a winner from June 22nd. Is there a lesson that you take going forward?
Again, I'm new to politics. This is my first time running, so I really didn't look at any of the polls or anything like that. But obviously, I was elected and selected by, you know, a group of people from within the city, a group of citizens. And I'm sure you want to hear what I have to say on, you know, police reform. So,
or officers in schools, SROs, et cetera, right?
I can talk relative to that, too. But in order to go forward, I think sometimes we have to go back, you know, to what brought us, you know, to, you know, where we are today. So let's reimagine a new form of policing. Bill, it's ironic that Mayor Johnson is here. I took his class at RIT on community working or cities working or something like that years ago, more than a decade or two ago. And I wrote a paper on community policing before he took the position as mayor. And I spoke relative to community policing and how that would be an advancement for us in this city as far as policing. And I think I should say I know some of the things that were written in that paper the former mayor put into policy. So that was a win-win for me. And but when we talk about defunding the police, I think that's a wrong term. That term is not appropriate for some individuals that truly don't know the definition, you know, of that. So a better word would have been reallocation of resources, you know, when it comes to policing. So, for example,
but you think that's what people want? You think that's what Democrats want?
Again, I really don't know per se from the police end of it, being in it 27 years.
Yep.
And now being a citizen since 2010. I think I speak for, you know, some of the community where we talk about reallocating resources, not getting rid of the police. As we see right now, the decline in moral values, the increase in homicides, the younger individuals with guns and committing these homicides. So, no, I think that I know we cannot get rid of the police, which some people think that's what defunding the police means. You know, maybe in suburban areas, but not in our urban areas, our urban cities, ourselves, Chicago, you know, Los Angeles, these larger communities. You could not survive without a police agency.
Rachel Barnhart won on June 22nd. In fact, Bill's the only one here who didn't win an election on June 22nd. We'll talk to him in a second. Rachel won a primary as well. And you're likely to stay in the Monroe County Legislature. What do you make of the way David Lainhart and Pew Research break down the electorate right now?
Oh, there's so much to say about this. First, I love the topic of this show. And if there's one thing I want your listeners to take away from it, it's that elections are really complicated and more than one thing can be true. You know, you have to put a lot of different things in a pot and stir. Racial, ethnic, religious identity matters. How much money candidates have matters. Name ID matters. Issues matter. Maybe not as much as people think. Organization matters. How many volunteers do you have? Do you know what you're doing? And also, who's the opposition? Who are the other candidates? And I think what we saw in Rochester and Buffalo and New York City, we saw a split electorate. Voters told us a lot of things. The same voters delivered both moderate and progressive candidates in the same election on June 22nd. In Rochester, Willie Lightfoot and Cynthia Elliott, people who I consider probably a little more socially conservative, they were the top vote-getters in their races. But we also elected Stanley Martin and Kim Smith, two progressives. So now we go on city council from Mary Lupien, who was kind of the lone, really more far to the left voice. Now we have Stanley and Kim, who are poised to join her. Neither mayoral candidate was progressive in this race. So this was not about ideology. I don't think anyone can really say the Rochester mayor's race was about ideology or issues. And in Rochester, you're seeing progressives organize in a way that we've frankly only seen the establishment organize in the past. The Working Families Party and Citizen Action, they're now getting very sophisticated as political operations and how they help campaigns. The People's Slate, a group of progressive candidates that banded together to raise money and canvass together and campaign together. Some of their candidates won, and I have no doubt that the organizing power, as well as the power of their message and the quality of their candidates, that really helped. And I think we have to take at Eric Adams' win in New York City and put it in context here. First of all, he walked in with a huge base. You know, he was a current elected official, had been for quite some time. And the polls there showed a huge racial divide, as you noted at the top of the show. He's very well known. There was also a generational divide. And I think you're seeing that in a lot of places when it comes to a lot of issues. And older voters definitely supported him. And also about Eric Adams, first of all, he barely won. And he's actually a progressive. Over the weekend, he joined Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan DA, likely next DA. And agreed with Alvin Bragg that we shouldn't prosecute low-level crimes. The two of them agreed on many different issues. I believe Eric Adams supported Bernie Sanders. Someone can correct me on that. But you know, he's long called out police misconduct. And if crime and defunding the police was such a huge, this is my last point, if crime and defunding police was such a huge issue that was hobbling Democrats, why, when Republicans spent millions of dollars to make crime a central issue back in November 2020, did we get the most progressive state legislature that we've ever seen? So I think elections are complicated, and I think there's a lot of different things that you can read into it, but you can't boil it down to one headline.
I hear that, but Eric Adams clearly was saying you have to have security, you have to have safety first, and we're not going to defund the police. He was clear on that.
I think you get into what does defund the police mean, because
sure,
he also in
to
the
James's
New York
point.
In the New York Post today said we have to tackle root causes. And I think what you're seeing here is people are really grappling with this challenge. We had a press conference in Rochester, I think it was last week, with the feds and local police, and everyone agreed root causes are a problem. Nobody had a plan for root causes. They only had a plan for what police should do. But what you're seeing is Democrats say two things, and sometimes they say two things in the same exact poll. They say, oh, yeah, no, I want police reform, and I want more resources allocated to things like mental health and housing and education. But they also say, you can't cut my police right now. So, I think Democrats agree on a lot of different things.
Okay. Bill Johnson, what were you doing on June 22nd? How come you weren't winning a primary? Everybody else here won primaries.
Sam, thank you, Jesus. Been there, done that.
So what did you, I know you read the piece from Lane Hardin. You took a look at the Pew Research, and I'm curious to know where you come down on what this is saying. Because Lane Hardin in the New York Times is basically saying that if Democrats don't heed this message, they will lose elections in 2022 and 2024. What do you think, Bill?
Well,
I'm going to make you get right to your microphone, by the way. Grab that mic and get real close to it.
Let me say that everything that's been said here so far, I can agree with parts of it. This is a very complicated thing, and as somebody who's run five elections and lost two of them, so I've been on both sides of the equation. And I know that at the end of the day, you don't know why exactly you won. If you win in the first time, as I did, in a multi-candidate field, and you can't figure out why you lost, as I did, running off the Democratic line. And so what that said to me is that people are very targeted in their behavior, and they may know very little about the candidates. One of the factors Rachel didn't mention was position on the ballot. And I'll bet you, if you go back and look, very few people on the lower end of that ballot won if they didn't have name recognition. Nobody knew them. They knew what they stood for, because we don't get full reporting on political campaigns like we used to. But I will say that looking at that New York Times article and Eric Adams' win, I don't know a lot about Eric Adams. I've read about him, and particularly in this race, and he's a controversial figure in more than one respect. But as Rachel said, he came in with high name recognition, and it was a multi-candidate field. So, you know, going head-to-head against any of those people, we don't know how he would have fared.
He didn't
have
to. His
opposition split the vote.
Yeah.
Okay? So I think that the question about where black voters stand on the ideological scale is one that has to really be reckoned with. I know this based on my own experience. Black voters are not monolithic, and many of them are a lot more conservative than the public really wants to acknowledge. And they aren't buying get rid of the police.
You're saying they're not buying it?
They're not buying that because they live in the neighborhoods that are under siege. Why would they want to give up policing? What I believe the informed discussion should be is how do we reform many aspects of policing, starting from the recruitment end, all the way to the end of how do we evaluate them so that they can retain that service. If you look at the Ray's report, we added one critical element there, a recertification of police officers every 3 years. Many careers require professionals to be recertified. Police officers get a lifetime appointment, and I don't necessarily believe, particularly when you consider how well rewarded. This is one of the best rewarded jobs in mankind. You get to retire, if you want to, in your early 40s. That means you retire with a pension of 50% of your salary, and you can go start another career and work another 20 to 25 years and retire, if the employer offers it, a full pension. You get health insurance for life, okay? And all of this is being financed and underwritten by the public. And the public has every right to determine the criteria by which police officers who police them should be selected. And the criteria that we employ in 2021, it's going to be a whole lot different than the criteria we employed in 1991. So those standards need to be upgraded. The curriculum needs to be upgraded. And so there are a lot of factors about things about policing. I do not support the current iteration of policing. I think there are changes that need to be made. But I do not support anyone who will say to me, without giving me any good definition, and I say with all due respect to Ms. Smith and her colleagues, I've been waiting for a fully articulated plan of what defunding the police means. And I know she's not on that spectrum as much as others. I don't think I've ever met her. Everything I read about her, and I think I may have even voted for her, says she's going to make a good council person. But I'm still waiting for a full articulation of what defund the police means and how you provide protection to people who need it in that atmosphere of defunding the police.
I'm going to ask Kim in a second if she wants to address it. I think that's part of the point that James Patterson was making. We're using language that sometimes the general public hears defund and we mean different things. But Bill Johnson, when you say, especially the black electorate is not a monolith, but generally speaking, they don't want no police or defund police. Do you feel like people understand what activists mean, what the intentions are?
I believe that the events of last summer were extremely important and contributed to the public dialogue. I think it forced a conscious awareness. And I think that the only problem is this, Derek Chauvin, and I've only started calling him by name after he got convicted. I refused to call him by name before. But Derek Chauvin, there was no way that Derek Chauvin was ever going to be acquitted. He committed murder in the full view of the public.
This country has acquitted many people like him.
But they didn't have the kind of hard evidence they had. And cite another time when as many police officers, his colleagues, came and testified against him. All right? And you had an aggressive prosecution who didn't waver in their determination. You had probably the best of all worlds. Think about it. Derek Chauvin was acquitted, and less than 15 minutes later, a young black girl got murdered by the police up in Columbus, Ohio. All right? And within 72 hours of Derek Chauvin's acquittal, we'd had almost a dozen examples of police deadly force. So we have a lot of work to do. Derek Chauvin got what he deserved. He should have gotten more time. He got what he deserved. He got a finding of guilt by a jury. But there was incontrovertible evidence that the eye could not. And so many people who don't want to even deal with the question of police abuse had no choice but to say this man's behavior goes beyond the pale. It is unacceptable. And let's remove him from our midst. But I want to see this slew of other prosecutions that are going to come, and we haven't seen them.
Okay, well, I got to give, because Kim Smith's time is going to run short, so let me let her respond to some of what the mayor said. Go ahead, Kim.
Well, first, Mayor Johnson, I want to say if you did vote for me, thank you, and I appreciate that vote. I guess my comment would be is that we can talk semantics all day around what the messaging could or should have been. But the reality of it is, if you know anything about grassroots organizing, or if you know anything about activists, the messaging has to be strong or else we will not grab attention. If we had come out and said, stop killing us, stop the police brutality, that messaging has gone on for centuries and no one has listened to it. Then suddenly out comes defund the police, reinvest in communities, and now the entire nation is having the conversation about police reform. So messaging matters. And to some degree, as Mayor Johnson mentioned, everyone wants police reform. And what people are tired of are the same strategies, but just different iterations of them. And if we did retrain the police, cultural competence, all of these pieces that everyone is discussing, and we kept the same amount of officers on the force, then what? There is a very fine line between what is a deterrent and what is a viable strategy. And when we talk about putting more police on the street, surely that is a deterrent. A deterrent from any violation of the law happening within that moment when the police are present. But what we want to look at are long-term strategies that involve prevention, intervention, and positive long-term outcomes. And that is what reinvest in community means, so that we are not solely reliant on police departments for our community safety.
Bill Johnson, does that answer your question?
Yes, and I concur with that. We cannot continue to put all of the resources we put into policing. I've submitted 12 budgets with policing, and I will tell you, the police budgets were always viewed as sacrosanct. You can't cut the police. You can cut the fire department, but you can't cut the police department. And we know that should not be that way. There are a lot of things that policemen are called to do that other people can do, civilians can do a lot of this work at a much lower annual income and with the same level of results. So I think that with Ms. Smith and her colleagues on the city council, I hope that they will engage in this vigorous examination, not only of the elements of policing, but how the police are being financed, and to find ways that money can be rerouted into other services.
Well, as she's got to go, let me just ask Kim Smith, have you read the Raise Commission report, Kim, and are there recommendations there that you're interested in?
I have read the Raise report, and I think I have more questions than comments, and I would surely like to have a conversation a bit more about some of the Raise Commission, because I know, first of all, I am impressed at what they did touch on. I think it is a very comprehensive report. I just have a lot of questions, but I just want to say to Mayor Johnson and his peers, very comprehensive report. As I read in your foreword, you couldn't capture everything, but you captured what you could. And I'm anxious to see what those variables are for your measuring success.
I'll be happy to talk to you anytime about that, Kim. So let's try to sit down and do that.
Look at us. Making connections here. Kim Smith,
I
know you got to go. I really appreciate the time, as always, and I look forward to our next conversation, Kim.
Appreciate you, Evan. Bye-bye.
Kim's a winner of the recent Democratic primary for Rochester City Council and almost certainly going to be on City Council starting in 2022. We're talking about what we learned, if we can really even sum up what we've learned from the primary elections and who won and where. I think maybe there's a danger in overemphasizing any single one winner. You know, James Patterson is a former law enforcement officer, 27 years, you said, James, right?
Yes.
Who won a seat on the Rochester City School Board in a year in which you had Willie Lightfoot, among others, winning. And I think, as Rachel Barnhart kind of, if you're categorizing, probably leaning a little bit more culturally conservative than some of the others in that race. But then you had Kim Smith, you just heard, Stanley Martin, and they talked about from the streets to the seats, and they won. In New York City, you had Eric Adams, who was a former law enforcement officer himself, who was unabashedly against defunding police, who wins there. But as the panelists have pointed out, he got about 30% of the vote in a very crowded field. So what are the lessons here? What do we actually know about voters? And what do you take with that going forward? How do you make policy going forward? And what do you assume you know about what people want? So James Patterson, you're likely to be on the school board. You're going to have to make decisions, for example, on law enforcement officers in schools.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a heated debate in this community.
Yes.
SROs in schools, should we have them?
Well, I agree with most of what's been said here, especially by the mayor. We have to reinvent police. And I work with a group of law enforcement officers. As a matter of fact, all the chiefs and the sheriff with the United Christian Leadership Ministry. So we are attempting to write or draw up MOUs with them. That involves a much kinder, gentler form of community policing. They are here to serve and protect, and we have to rid ourselves of that warrior mentality. You know, often we shouldn't look like the military, you know, when we're policing, you know, our communities. As far as the school district and the SROs that they have removed, we have to take a look at that. There needs to be a response to crime, which will make the classrooms a safe place and conduct conducive to learning. And that's what the teachers want, you know, just a classroom where it's safe, a safe environment where the kids can learn. So we do have to find a way to work with the police in some form, some shape. We, you know, again, they removed the SROs, but the SROs were often avenues that the kids could reach out to when there was going to be a serious incident, either within the school or off ground. So they formed those relationships. So for me personally, I think that it was a knee-jerk reaction to public pressure, you know, to withdraw the SROs from, you know, the schools. I think you're going to see in September that those SROs are really going to be needed when we see the environment and the culture, what's occurring on our streets today, you know, as far as the homicides and the guns and the youth that are involved. We have kids going from the east to the west and west to east and vice versa relative to schools and school choice and things like that. I'm for neighborhood schools. Why? Because that builds community. So if you put those kids back in community, it's somewhat, you know, when it comes to gangs, it separates, you know, those east and west, you know, issues that they do have when they're in school. But I want to be part of making those schools more conducive to learning. And community is key. Restorative practices and restorative justice, as we've known, we've spoken about. But there's also restorative practices where there's services that are brought right in to the school. There's a separate wing for social and emotional needs. You know, school number 19 is an example, you know, of that. So those are things that I like to bring, you know, to the school district. When the kids come in with issues and problems or whatever they're dealing with in anger, in the place of arresting them, and arresting, believe it or not, or suspending the victims of these assaults in school. That's not right either. So we have to make change and establish policy that protects the victim. But yes, I'm for police reform, and I'm for reallocation of services and working with the police to create a new form of policing. You know, but we need these kids need to have relationships with our law enforcement officers, and we need to work on that.
Well, can I quickly say?
Yeah, go ahead, Bill.
I agree with James. My administration introduced school resource officers, and not because we want a policeman in school, because at one point our high schools were the most dangerous places in the city between the hours of 8 a.m. and 3 p.m. And they were there to keep people from coming into the schools to do harm. So I agree with you. It was a knee-jerk reaction for people who just want to get rid of anything that's got a uniform on it and say, take them out of the school.
But, Bill, some people say,
hold on a minute.
People said that they're criminalizing.
Here's what happened.
Okay. Yeah.
They want to take the school resources out, but the school district created its own security force. They were hardly non-existent at the time back in the 90s. And now they've got this huge security force. Are they going to get rid of those people as well? Those are uniformed people wearing black
SSOs
and white uniforms who are in the schools, all right? And we and the thing that is so stunning to me is I sit here today on July the 11th, 2021, and it feels like July the 11th, 1994.
The year I graduated from high school at Marshall High, and that's when I met you, Bill.
Yes, and we're in the same period of chaos, of violence
yeah.
that we saw back then. And we had to take some extraordinary steps and try to arrest this violence to keep people from being killed. So I think that, you know, I didn't know James was running for the school board until he called me and put a sign in my yard. But I voted for you, too. I was welcome to see that kind of experience going to school board. And I think you can bring some real light to this discussion about why we need to protect those hundreds of thousands of kids who are trying to go to school and learn.
Let's let Rachel Barnhart jump in. Go ahead.
Yes. So I lived through the early 90s in the Rochester City School District at a time when our city was last this violent, frankly. And it really, I think, shaped a lot of my perspective today. And I guess I would challenge both of you. If we're back where we were, what have we done that has worked? Police have not prevented the violence that we are seeing today. So why do we think that police are going to have the solution?
You
I think
why?
We need to back up a million steps here.
You know why? And I'm going to say this, and I'm going to get myself.
You got to say it into the mic. Get closer.
I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, because under the current administration, the police department has been hobbled.
What is the evidence that police can't do
their
jobs?
Well, I give you one evidence, Rachel. There were scores of people raising hell in front of the mayor's house at midnight. The police were in the next block, and not one arrest was made. That's one piece of evidence I can give to you. All right. Because the mayor was under siege by her own basic constituents. And hopefully she believed that if she just went light on them, and I really want her to have a conversation with me about this, all right? If she went light on them, that somehow they would get religion. But there are some bad people out here, and the only response they know is to be arrested.
Well, I'll tell you what. Her police department certainly was not leashed when it fired 6,000 pepper balls in one weekend, one of which hit my head, and I've never had any apology or accountability for that.
Read our report,
a lot,
Rich, read
a
our
lot
report.
Of people were hurt
we
and injured.
We demanded an answer to that.
We haven't gotten one.
To this day, the police department has never explained who gave the order for pepper spray, who gave the order for police dogs. We're still waiting for that. I'm not disagreeing with you, but I don't say that then you say take away all the security.
Well,
let chaos.
But I think that's the wrong I think that's the wrong thing to take out of this debate. I mean, I think the whole thing that we're really debating in this show is whether the defund police movement is going to hurt Democrats at the polls. I mean, I think that's why we're here talking about this.
I think it's to be fair,
talking about why defund the police will hurt the community.
Okay. Hold on.
But AOC said something that really opened my eyes to what this movement is all about, because I struggled with the term for a long time. And when she said, "You know what defunding police looks like? It looks like a suburb." And then I thought, well, yeah, I mean, Pittsburgh doesn't have a police department. It doesn't. Okay, why doesn't Pittsburgh have a police department? We know those reasons why. And some of the ways that we can solve the reasons why we need a police department are, frankly, out of the hands of the city and go right on out to the federal government. This child tax credit will help. I mean, we need resources. That's what makes Pittsford different. It has resources that we don't have. And how do we build those opportunities? How do we build those jobs, the education, the housing? How do we make our community one where it doesn't need its own police department and can rely on the countywide department? And I think that's how we have to look at it. It is a chicken and the egg discussion. Nobody wants to take away public safety. We don't have the infrastructure. India Walton in Buffalo, a race that we haven't talked about this hour, which is very relevant. She said, I campaigned on defunding the police, but I know we can't do that because we don't have any alternate infrastructure in place. We don't. And to me, that alternate infrastructure means really investing in people. And we have no plan to do that. We don't have a plan. So when you say, Bill, what's the plan? We have no leaders that have come forward and said, here's the plan. And there's one other thing I would mention. You know, I asked the county administration when all the violence, when it became very clear we were in for a ride here this summer. And I asked, you know, what are we doing to tackle this problem? And I was told, well, you know, we're not really doing a whole lot. But then I found out after meeting with two wonderful department heads, Thalia Wright and April Acock, we actually are doing a lot from a human services perspective. And we can do more with the proper resources that we don't have. And so that's the conversation that I want to be having, not one of cracking down on citizens.
But I'm not sure Bill Johnson and James Patterson would disagree
with
you.
That's right.
They
would
probably say
that
for this moment, James wants to see SROs back, or maybe we need more security in different places, or maybe Bill Johnson would say, this is not the moment to take police off streets. Yes, we want resources. Yes, we want more an equitable society that undoes or repairs some of the harms that were intentionally created in racist ways decades ago. But until we get there, is this the moment? That's sort of what I'm hearing.
Crime is really complicated, and we don't know the reasons it goes up and down. Criminologists don't even agree. There's just a lot of different reasons for it. And I haven't seen a plan about this recent surge of violence. I haven't seen one that seems viable to me at all. I mean, we closed schools for a year and a half, and what did we think was going to happen with we literally put our most vulnerable kids out there with no support, and then we're surprised that this is the result? I mean, I just haven't seen a plan that tackles some of the root causes, and I think there are things that we can do today. I think there are at-risk youth. We know who they are. They're not in school. They're not working. There are things that we can do today, and there are things that we can do longer term. I really am interested in the governor's proposal where he wants to tackle this from a public health perspective. Not impressed with the details so far or the funding, but I think we have to be having those conversations. I do think there are immediate things that we can do. But I just think arguing over whether we should remove police today isn't really the discussion we should be having.
Okay, so here's what I want to do. I want to close the loop on where Bill Johnson and Rachel Barnhart had some disagreement. I want to hear from James Patterson. I've got to get some feedback from listeners as well. But Bill Johnson, just briefly, when you said the police were hobbled, and Rachel Barnhart is saying she doesn't see the evidence of that. I mean, do you feel right now police are still in this city? You use the word hobbled. Is that the case right now?
Well, I hear them say that they're overworked. They're working double shifts. There are vacancies that aren't being filled. And there is a need. Look, Rachel and I, who I have tremendous admiration and respect for Rachel, you know, we can sit down, and if we were given the power and the authority, we could devise multifaceted strategies to attack this problem. All right? And we're not at that table. I don't want to be there because my time is past. All right? But what I'm saying is that we need to go back and look at what happened in the past, look at some of the strategies, take advantage of experienced people like James Patterson, who's moved to another career, and begin to address this. And at-risk youth is not the same as a person walking around with a semi-automatic or an automatic rifle pumping bullets into people. That person has moved beyond being at risk and being a danger to society. And we've got to be prepared, as hard as it is, to look very subjectively and make those decisions. Here's this one. Now, we don't send them to prison where there's no rehabilitation. We need to figure out a structure. How do we get and try to reclaim those youth? But you can't solve this problem by one strategy fits all, because it does not work. We're dealing with people who have different emotions, different responses, take different paths to try to resolve whatever's going on in their lives. And I think we need to create the systems for that. All this talk about nor mental health. I believe in it, but we need to open up the mental health systems long before a person is looking down the barrel of a gun and out on the street acting up. We need to expand access to mental health for people who don't carry insurance cards, who walk and who can't pay a fee to a certain. There's just a lot of questions, and I think that Rachel and I are not disagreeing. I think what we're saying is we're frustrated because we should not be seeing this cycle repeat itself.
Okay. James Patterson, go ahead, sir.
A couple of notes that I just put in here while we were talking. So first of all, I also worked on the race committee, but more on the mental health portion, not really on the criminal justice side. But IBM did a study some decades ago relative to Rochester, and they said Rochester was rich on resources, but there's no interconnectivity. So we are rich on resources here in Rochester. When it comes to the SROs, you know, through national campaigns and activists, you know, pushing these educational institutions, being police and school to prison pipelines, I'm familiar with that too. You know, some of the things and their agenda that they pushed. Again, because of those agendas being pushed, I still think there was a knee-jerk reaction to SROs. I think that we can bring back a form of SROs that are retrained on, you know, how to react, you know, with our students that is more acceptable to these parents and these activists that pushed, you know, their agenda. So I truly believe that we're going to need them come September, you know, in our schools. And again, if there's some retraining, again, I'm all for a new form of policing that I've been mentioning to we've been mentioning to the chiefs of police. If you're not on board with a new form of policing, community policing and serving the public and getting rid of that warrior mentality, you're going to have issues in your departments. That's urban and suburban. So that's the message that we've been relaying to them. But I think when it comes to the school, that I don't think in this day and age, in this era, that we can totally rid our school systems of law enforcement. We need to build those positive relationships because these kids are often seeing police officers in a negative light when they respond to the residences for domestics and homicides, as we know, drugs, narcotics, opioid, you know, overdoses, et cetera, et cetera. But we need to build positive relationships with these individuals within schools who are often the individuals who these kids talk to. Build upon those relationships. When it comes to crime and what's going to happen within the schools, they have to have an outlet that they trust, you know, to provide this information to, that's not going to give up their sources.
Let me get some feedback here. I'm going to take Tim first in Rochester. Go ahead, Tim.
I just wanted to say that, first of all, that I have so much respect for everybody there, Mayor Johnson, Rachel. You know, you've got a great panel of people there. I just was hoping to say that when people use language, as much as I, you know, respect activism, I'm a person who actually marched on Broadway in New York City against Anita Bryant when she was pushing against the LGBTQ community, as well as ACT UP in San Francisco. I can say, you know, definitely activism matters. But as Kim was pointing out earlier, saying something like defund the police got people's attention. It also got a lot of negative attention. And it's very, very hard to put that back in the bottle. I don't think Dems really are that great at communication. They sometimes walk into these booby traps over and over and over again, and it gets used against them. And I remember a while back, Evan, you had the mayor of Cornell on, which is down in the southern tier.
Yep.
And he was saying to you very directly, if I remember correctly, that language like defund the police or socialism is another one. These are just terms that, yes, you can split them in a million different ways, but nobody has the time for that. You know, it punches once, it punches twice, and that's it. And so once that's out there, you know, it puts the Democratic candidate or the progressive candidate on the defense, and you never want to be on the defense.
So Tim,
I would just add one last thing about the SROs and so forth,
mm-hmm.
You know, in terms of education, this reminds me so much of the conversations that were being held a while back regarding teachers. We just, you know, teacher evaluations and all the rest of that. And now we're doing this. We're doing a similar thing, a reevaluation of what it means to be an effective police officer. And I think in both instances, what you have, and you've kind of touched on this, is that we're expecting these individuals to do everything in terms of solving some of the most serious social ills that we have. And it's just an impossible, it's really an impossible task, especially in urban environments. And I think one of the best examples that sometimes gets overlooked with this is East High School, where that school was completely reformed. And yes, a tremendous amount of money went into that school. And there's your answer. I mean, it can change, but the resources need to be there.
All right. Well, I appreciate all of that, Tim. And what I want to do is I want to build on Tim's call and read an email from a listener who is an activist, who is, you know, so you heard Tim talk about people who don't understand the meaning of defund the police. Bill Johnson said he wanted an answer on what it actually means in practice. James Patterson saying people are confused about meanings and sometimes it gets twisted. Here's Ray Ray, who writes to say, if you don't understand defund or refund, and you need to have it fully articulated, then you are not in the paradigm to understand it. It's about liberation. It's about transformative justice. Plenty of people are articulating and doing it. You're just not listening because you don't want to. Bill Johnson, what would you say to Ray Ray, who says, if you're still wondering what it means and you're just not listening and you don't want to?
Well, I don't know Ray Ray, so I'm not going to get into any argument with him. He has his opinion. I still say I would love to see a clearly articulated definition, not only of what it means, but where it has worked. I know a couple of places it's been tried and not too successfully. But I think that that is beyond the point. I believe, as I listen to everyone who is expressing a concern, what they are saying is that policing in its current form and iteration needs to change in every aspect. We need to change what we ask them to do. We need to refine that. We need to change who we ask to do it. And we need to hold them accountable for what they do. I believe that everyone who's having this discussion would agree with those basic elements.
Sure. And James Patterson, I want to hear your thoughts. You've brought up the warrior mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a conversation with someone who has worked in real reform, and this is, I'm not going to mention who it was. It was a private conversation, but let me just say that this person told me that there are some police departments who, when they are trained, when new recruits are trained, the first thing they're shown is a video of a police officer at a traffic stop who is executed by someone, shot 7 times and killed. And they are told in that moment when they're watching this video as a police trainee, this is what you are up against. Prepare for this. And that is inculcated from the start. And this person who is doing the reforming told me they actually have empathy for police officers because they say many of these officers, and Bill Johnson has pointed out, we don't even know what training sometimes happens. We need better freedom of information there. But from the jump, you're taught this is a war on the streets and you're going into it. And this person said, I'm trying to have empathy because these officers have been taught this, but we can't teach that anymore. Is there agreement on that? Is there growing at least agreement on that? And can that actually happen?
Yeah, I don't know where that even came from, because when I was in policing, you know, we didn't, the first thing we didn't do was put our hand on our gun or draw our gun on each vehicle and traffic stop. I don't know where that form of training came to. You've already heightened, you know, the stop or the incident,
yeah.
You know, when you pull your gun, you've already got the person in the car, you know, nervous and, you know, at a defensive posture. You know, why do you have your hand on your gun, or why do you have a gun out for the most part? There's been shooting incidents that we know within not only our state, but throughout the United States, shootings that are just uncalled for. You know, what happened to in law enforcement to defensive tactics and pressure points and come-alongs and things like that that I was trained in? Why are there so many shootings of people, black and brown people? You know, now you're seeing it, you know, on camera. Everyone's videotaping it. But let's go all the way back to Rodney King. Rodney King, if you beat a person like an animal like that, we'd arrest you for cruelty to animals. How were they allowed to beat that man like that? And no one was prosecuted for that.
So Rachel Barnhart, I know you wanted to jump in. There's been a lot there.
Oh, there is a lot to say. I think talking about police reform, and certainly in the context of bad officers and good officers, is way too reductive. Mm-hmm. We need system-wide changes. And at the one hand, I'm hearing our fellow guests here saying that there shouldn't be a war, and yet they're using language about our current situation like we're under siege. And I'm seeing even the media report using language like, you know, portraying Rochester as the Wild West and chaotic, and the poor police department is beleaguered and put upon. We need to start centering residents, the community, and what the community's needs are, not the police department. The police department did not prevent any of the things that we're going through right now, and they're not going to be the solution. Of course, they have a role, and of course, we have to recognize the humanity of officers, but we really, really have forgotten that we need to recognize the humanity of victims, their families, and the community impacted by this trauma. And the discussions of violence going on right now have really forgotten those things.
Bill, 45 seconds. Is under siege the wrong term? She's highlighting the fact that you use that term about Rochester neighborhoods.
Yeah, I'm talking about they've been under siege, not by police officers, but by civilians. Okay? And to the point that the police haven't been able to prevent this, I don't know of a single instance where a person calls 911 and says, at 20 minutes from now, at the corner of Lyle and Plymouth, I'm going to shoot my friend. Send a police car down there to stop it. This stuff is all spontaneous. It's sporadic. It's unpredictable. And so what we need to do is figure out why people act that way. And we don't need to start figuring that out at the moment that they begin to act that way. We need to go back to all of our systems when they're young kids, when they're in elementary school. Are we essentially exposing them, giving them the right services?
Yeah.
That's the way we're going to solve this problem.
And I have to say, as we close the program, since I live in the city of Rochester, and I'm happy to live in the city of Rochester, if you're listening to this and you don't, the city of Rochester has way too much violence. But I feel safe in the city of Rochester. And I don't live in just the leafiest parts, if you want to categorize it that way. Much of the violence is still very targeted. It's often drug-related. There's a lot of complex issues at play. But I don't want to stoke fear in the city. I want solutions. And I'm grateful for Bill Johnson, James Patterson, Rachel Barnhart, Kim Smith earlier this hour. Thank you all for being here. Thanks for this conversation.
Thank you, Evan.
And let's continue this. Please, listeners, I know there's a lot more to say on this. Rob Braden, engineer. MRA Stein, production assistant. Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.